here actually for the second time in the space of a year to speak to us on the LRA. Ryme, I think it's fair to say, really is one of the premier scholars on northern Uganda and a whole range of issues relating to the Lord's Resistance Army. Ryme at the moment is a professor of African history and the director of African studies at the University of South Carolina. I had the real privilege of meeting Ron on a bus to northern Uganda about 4 years ago in the early days of the International Criminal Court's investigations in the north. So Ron, it's a real pleasure to have you back here in Oxford and to speak to us. The format really for today, I think, is that Ron is going to present for the first sort of 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll use the remaining hour or so to have, a fairly fluid discussion on both the issues that Ron's going to raise in the presentation and then some more general questions about northern Uganda and the current situation with the LRA in the region. But Ron, thanks very much.
Thank you. Phil, I'd like to thank you for setting us up in the midst of an incredibly busy personal program for you. And I'd also like to equally thank all of you for coming, because I know all of you are very busy as well at this time of year. So thank you for coming. I've titled this sort of fairly brief presentation, Displaced Conflict, the Regionalization of the Lord's Resistance Army. In July 2006, peace talks mediated by the neighboring government of South Sudan, GOS, began in Juba to end 20 years of war in northern Uganda. In February 2008, after more than 2.5 years of difficult, protracted, and halting negotiations, delegations from the Rebel Lord's Resistance Army / Movement and the government of Uganda signed off on a comprehensive final peace agreement. The rebel leader, Joseph Kony, was scheduled to add his signature 2 months later on 10 April. He failed to do so. A month later, he was to meet a delegation of religious, cultural, and political leaders whom he had invited to discuss issues that had led him not to sign, and prominent among those issues by this date was the arrest warrants from the International Criminal Court. He failed to appear. Nearly 6 months then passed without further progress. Then in early November 2008, there was a stakeholders meeting, stakeholders involved in the Juba peace process in Kampala. Kony was given a 30 November deadline to sign, and he signaled a willingness to do so. A 29-30 November meeting was set up for this to happen. Once again, Joseph Kony failed to show up. 2 weekends later, on Sunday, 14 December 2008, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF, the Ugandan Army, began bombing LRA camps in Garamba National Park in northeastern DRC, that sort of in the bottom right-hand corner. The rebels had first established a base in Garamba in 2005, and then had mainly relocated there and just across the border in South Sudan during the peace talks. The air attacks were meant to be the surprise opening of a multi-pronged offensive against the LRA, codenamed Operation Lightning Thunder. The operation officially ended 3 months later, on 15 March 2009, when the UPDF abruptly began what was announced as an 8-day process of withdrawal from the DRC, the Congo. But the UPDF hunt for the LRA has continued up to today, more than a year after their announced departure. Two UPDF commanders at the official end of the operation offered assessments. As part of the official handover ceremony to the Congolese Army, the FARDC, the Uganda's Chief of Defense Forces, General Aronda Jakarima, said that the UPDF was leaving at a time when the LRA was, quote, at their weakest point we have ever seen. Air Force Chief of Staff, Colonel Moses Rakitarata, added, quote, UPDF's victory is not capturing Kony, which was the initial claim that this was all about. It was not capturing Kony, but failing the enemy's normal operations. Therefore, Operation Lightning Thunder was a success, because we have managed to kill many of Kony's fighters and rescue over 300 abductees. This was at the end of the three-month official Operation Lightning Thunder. Did Operation Lightning Thunder leave the LRA at their weakest point? Was the operation a success? How should success or not be measured? And how does this latest effect to end the more than 20-year war in northern Uganda fit within the historical context of that war? And then finally, what might come next? What might come next that could establish peace and stability in northern Uganda and the wider region of which it's a part? I got involved in these questions because I was in Uganda in December and the first half of December 2008 and the first half of 2009. And one of the things that happened within weeks of the beginning of the operation, there began to be whispers through northern Uganda, through all kinds of networks, that what was happening, what we were reading in the newspapers, what the UPDF and the Uganda government was reporting, was not anywhere near the full story. And one of the biggest things that was being talked about was that the UPDF was claiming almost no losses in their operation. They were also claiming relatively few LRA killed and captured, but almost no deaths. And at the end of the 3 months, there was an official report in which the UPDF acknowledged losing 12 men. Again, what was circulating was something very different than that. And I decided that I wanted to see if I could find out a little bit more about that. So I ended up meeting with some former LRA who were not in Garamba when the attacks occurred, but they were junior officers. They were very close to Vincent Oti, Cohen's former second in command before Oti was killed by Cohen. They're very connected. They had contact in prison with both former LRA who'd been captured and UPDF who'd been imprisoned after this operation, because many UPDF soldiers deserted. That's also something that wasn't reported. I also went to the Uganda-Congo border in West Nile and met a couple of Ugandan UPDF deserters and talked with them. And they all said that the death toll from the UPDF was not 12, but hundreds. And then there were several other things that these different sources revealed. So anyway, I ended up writing about this in the Independent News Weekly, edited by Andrew Wenda, in June and July of last year, when I left Uganda, which I was advised that I should do after I left, because the identity of these people telling me these things was definitely at risk if that identity was known. Okay, what I'd like to do is two things in the presentation today. And I would welcome in the discussion, if there's a chance to talk about some more of the historical background. As a historian, of course, I would welcome that, but we'll see what happens in the discussion. So I'd like to take about 15 or 20 minutes to revisit and critically assess the events of the last year and a half, beginning with Operation Lightning Thunder. This part of the lecture will be based on a public lecture, or this part of the session will be based on a public lecture that I gave last week at Nordic Africa Institute in Uppsala, and also on a paper and publication in December last year at the New York-based International Peace Institute called Pursuing the Lord's Resistance Army. It's available and online. I'd also like to incorporate today two really recent sources. One is a report by the International Crisis Group that came out just a couple of weeks ago, an impressively researched report. I mean, those reports often are. This is even more so than usual. Have any of you happened to see this most recent ICG report? Some of you have, okay. And second, field notes based on visits to LRA-affected areas in South Sudan, DRC, and Central African Republic, CAR, in January, February, and March of this year by a young colleague from the U.S.-based NGO called Resolve Uganda. His name is Paul Ronan. And I was supposed to have accompanied Paul on this trip, on these visits. It was very complicated to set up. But the second night of the first leg of the trip, I had an accident, and I'm still hobbling from that 4 months later. So I wasn't able to make that trip. But Paul's very graciously provided me all of his field notes, and I'll refer to just at least a summary of those notes. And then secondly, I hope after the presentation we can discuss this issue of what can come next, what practically, realistically might come next to make this situation better especially for the literally hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in that corner of northeastern DRC, southwestern South Sudan, and southeastern CAR. Okay, Operation Lightning Thunder and its aftermath. We'll get into that part of it, and then this should take again about 15 minutes, I think. I'd like to quickly run through a dozen points related to the operation and the aftermath. The first is that although the operation was proclaimed from the beginning as a joint venture with the FARDC, the Congolese forces, and the SPLA, the South Sudanese Army, it was an overwhelmingly UPDF affair from the beginning. And in fact, its two partner forces and their governments weren't even notified that the operation was underway until it had begun. And they played only a minor role at best, and often a very resentful role, because they hadn't been included from the beginning. Two, who was involved from the beginning, at least from June of 2008, was the US government and military. There's a military attaché in Kampala now who was part of the initial meetings between the US Army and the UPDF. And this involvement eventually reached all the way to the top, to then President Bush, who signed off on the operation, on the U.S. involvement, and actually even, and this is in the ICG reporting, I hadn't seen this before, Bush actually called both Kabila in DRC and Salva Kiir in South Sudan asking their cooperation. The U.S. is also involved in the planning of the operation and subsequently supplied training, sophisticated electronic equipment, and funding. And they continue to be involved today in a fairly major way. Three, the overall plan of the assault, a plan assisted by the U.S. military, seems clear. Intelligence amassed over the several preceding months while supposedly the peace talks were still in play, including the use of sophisticated electronic monitoring devices and other high-tech equipment provided by the U.S. set the stage for the operation. The offensive was to begin with surprise air attacks by jets and helicopter gunships on the camps, and Cohen's personal hut had been targeted for attack. Special forces troops commanded by President Museveni's son were then to be delivered to the bombed camps by the helicopter gunships to secure the camps and carry out search and destroy operations against LRA who survived the air attacks and the bombings. Finally, a much larger ground offensive of more than 4,000 troops and perhaps many more, the number was never made very clear, was to follow up the air and commando attacks to continue any remaining operations against a rebel force that was already to have been hit hard. Four, what happened was something quite different. There was no surprise. Reports from Garamba from both LRA fighters and former abductees indicate that Cohen ordered the evacuation of the camps before the airstrikes began. He knew they were coming. So the camps were empty or nearly so. There were some abductees who were not fighters in the camps. Some of them were killed, but the fighters were mostly out of the camps. There were no special forces or other UPDF troops dropped off by helicopter gunships immediately after the bombings. So Cohen, his top commanders, and nearly all of his fighters were neither killed nor captured. Indeed, UPDF boots were not on the ground near and in the bombed camps until at least 3 days later. Operationally, this is inconceivable. The UPDF explanation, a public explanation or excuse, was that the terrain was difficult, surely something that they knew before beginning the operation. But this gave the rebels days to divide into small groups and scatter widely with control and command structures basically intact. Five, despite UPDF and Government of Uganda claims of success after the official end of the operation and often since then, up to recently, this seems a questionable and premature, if not dubious, assessment. Indeed, the International Crisis Report of 2 weeks ago states baldly in its opening paragraph that the operation is, quote, the Ugandan Army's latest attempts to crush the one-time Northern Uganda rebel group, and then adds, again, in quote, in It has been a failure. Six, the failure of the operation lies not only in the inability of the UPDF to crush the LRA, or capture or kill Joseph Cohn, but even more so in the failure to provide civilian protection and security after it began. There seems to have been no UPDF planning on this issue. This is especially egregious because anyone who knows anything about the LRA should have known that when the rebel group is pushed, let alone attacked, they will retaliate against soft targets that the rebels see as linked to or associated with those who are pushing them. In this case, those targets have been local civilians whose governments assisted or at least condoned the UPDF operation. But if the LRA escaped being hit hard by the UPDF, the local civilians have not been so fortunate. They have been hit very hard indeed by the LRA, with 1,000 or more killed, hundreds abducted, and up to 200,000 displaced in the first few months after the operation began. Over the 15 months since that, or 16 months, hundreds of more killings and abductions, and hundreds of thousands of additional people have been displaced over that wide swath of territory you can see up on the map, from South Sudan to northeastern DRC to southeastern Central African Republic. Some of these are internally displaced, some are refugees crossing borders where they thought they could get greater safety. Seven, one of the reasons that this response was predictable, and is always tragic, was that it follows the basic pattern of the war since it began in 1986. Indeed, the war can be considered to have passed through five discernible phases between 1986 and 2008. Each phase was of different duration and marked with different specific dynamics, different specific events, but all had a similar overall rhythm, a strong recurring pattern. Each began most often after failed or flawed peace talks with a period of acute insecurity and violence. This was followed by an interval during which these gradually declined, but until the Juba talks, never to the point of real peace in northern Uganda. But among the many benefits of the Juba talks that eventually did fail was that peace did come to northern Uganda. Fragile, tentative, but very real. In the current phase of the war, even though now displaced or exported to neighboring countries, the same pattern is repeating itself again. Failed or flawed peace talks, a UPDF, often military response, and then an LRA counter response targeting soft targets. Eight, indeed, the failure to protect civilians in the aftermath of Operation Lightning Thunder has been widely, almost universally, acknowledged as an unmitigated disaster. This began with the first NGO reports from Human Rights Watch and others in February 2009, in just a couple of months after it began, and has continued up to the report 2 weeks ago from the International Crisis Group. Initially, the UPDF disclaimed any responsibility from protecting civilians from LRA reprisals, and instead blamed its foe partners, the FARDC in Congo and the SPLA in South Sudan, along with the MONUC forces in the DRC. Widespread criticism on this issue that began very early stands in stark contrast to the almost equally widespread support of the operation when it first began. Nine, and again, there's a dozen of these, and then I'll be finished. Nine, it should be acknowledged, however, that the UPDF has subsequently made efforts to take civilian protection more seriously. And there are various sort of explanations or suppositions for why this is so. The two most common ones that show up in the ICG report are that the US military has been providing training along these lines, and secondly, the UPDF is being paid probably better than they've been paid at any point during the 20 plus years of and in contrast to the armies of South Sudan, DRC, and CAR. This greater attention by the UPDF on civilian protection has been noted by NGOs on the ground and many local groups and individuals. This is something that comes across in Paul Ronan's field notes over and over again. People do acknowledge that the UPDF is doing a better job of protection than the local armies. Although that's a pretty low bar to have set. Still, it's often noted that such improvement is limited in two ways. First, the UPDF, even though there are 5,000 to 7,000 troops estimated by the International Crisis Group, it could be even more, they're still scattered over a really wide area. They've even got one of their main bases, if you look up to Sam Wanja in northwestern CAR. It's one of their main bases, and they established a base, the UPDF did, because there were reports that Cohen was trying to get over to Darfur, maybe through Western Bahr al-Ghazal, maybe directly to Darfur. There have been reports frequently that he's been in Darfur. I'm not sure those reports are accurate, but they've been common. So they're spread across a very wide area, and so they're spread very thinly. They're thus unable, even with the best of intentions, to provide effective protection for civilians from the hornet's nest that they have stirred up. Secondly, a second indication that they're maybe not providing such grand protection is that not infrequently local people who've been attacked by the LRA have reported that the UPDF hasn't always responded quickly, even when they're nearby. One such example was a major LRA attack in Nzara. You can see it's in South Sudan, not very far from Garamba, just to the northwest of Garamba, but just across the border in South Sudan. That's a major UPDF base at Nzara. In August 2009, the local information indicates that the UPDF showed up first at the Catholic compound on the edge of town about 9 o'clock in the evening. They then proceeded for 6 hours to move from the Catholic compound on the outskirts of town into the center of Nzara, knocking down doors, looting, abducting people, until 3 a.m. They then withdrew with some of the people they've abducted with lots of loot, and those abductees were mostly to carry things. They left about 3 a.m. The UPDF showed up at 9 a.m., 6 hours after the LRA had gone and when the trail had grown cold, even though one of their major bases is right outside Nzara town. 10, in fact, it's often very difficult to gauge how and what precisely the UPDF has done or is doing, because the Army itself is the source for almost all information. The U.S., which is playing such an important role in all this, has no monitoring, really, of what the UPDF is doing. When I've talked to some of the U.S. Army people, they basically just repeat what they have been told by the UPDF. And from the very beginning of the operation, as I indicated at the beginning of this presentation, the information that's been provided by the UPDF has been questionable. Not surprising, but certainly has been questionable. So what I'd like to do to conclude is look quickly at a few of the points that the ICG makes in its report from a couple weeks ago, and then conclude with a few of the points that Paul Ronan has drawn from his visits that include, again, just some really quite remarkable details, some very heart-wrenching. With civilians who've been caught up in this, as well as with NGOs, UPDF, UN, other agencies. First, the ICG. Again, the first paragraph makes it clear that the ICG assessment of this whole affair is that it has been a failure. They point out that even with the help of this U.S. equipment and planning, etc., what was supposed to have been a quick strike has proven to be a long drawn out event or operation in which civilians have not been protected, and which has produced incredibly high civilian casualties in one form or another. The ICG's second major point is that even as the UPDF has killed or captured increasing numbers of Cohn's top officials, and again, the numbers aren't that impressive, but it's hard to know how many LRA there are. I'm quite sure that the UPDF and the U.S. consistently, because they have for years, have underestimated the numbers of the LRA. I think that's still probably true. But a number of LRA, including some fairly high-ranking officers, have been killed and captured or given themselves up. But the ICG reports that that's a double-edged sword in a way, because that could well mean that the command and control, and Cohn has always had, and his top people, very strict control, not in details, but sort of what their fighters did. That may be breaking down, the ICG is suggesting, and that could be even worse for local civilians, as sort of lone ranger small groups of LRA are kind of on their own to be predators against local populations. And they point out that this could often, or this could perhaps, maybe even likely continue even if Cohn is captured or killed. Three, the ICG argues, not surprisingly, that there needs to be a new strategy, and that that strategy should emphasize civilian protection. A really obvious but important point. It's not trivial. Far from it. And the fourth major recommendation of the ICG, or point, is that they note that for this really to be dealt with, Northern Uganda has to be dealt with by the Uganda government. To try and begin to address the feeling of people in the north, especially in Acholi, the epicenter of the war where I've spent most of my time over the past 5 years, that the feelings of alienation and not being treated fairly, not being incorporated, are addressed by the Uganda government. At least when I was there last in January, February, I still saw very little evidence that that was happening. Once they get to specific recommendations, the ICG report, it seems to me that most of them, while they're logical and needed, they're impractical in real political terms, because they ask or suggest involvement on the part of local armies in DRC, CIR, and South Sudan, local governments, the Uganda army and government, that I just don't see happening. The one thing that could happen, and that I would support most strongly, is that for the Ugandan and U.S. governments, that there's a clear goal and timeline for the operation set. And the ICG report or states it, such as the neutralization of the LRA leadership within a year, not have this be an open-ended affair, which it has been up to this point. Okay, quickly, if I can, some of the main points from Paul Ronan's trips to the three countries, January, February, March this year. The first point, and he reported this to the U.S. ambassador in Uganda, to the military attaché and others at the embassy in Kampala in March. His first point is that contrary to statements by the UPDF, by MONUC, the UN forces in Congo, and others, the LRA is not a desperate force on its last legs. It's not a desperate force on its last legs. That's a common refrain that we've seen over the 20 plus years of this conflict from the Uganda government and army. There's considerable evidence. Paul discovered that the LRA is functioning in an organized, strategic manner. For example, there have been meetings between commanders in parts of DRC north of northwest of Garamba, including the second in command of the LRA, meetings of commanders, elements or evidence that the LRA is trying to control some territory, and that they certainly have demonstrated they have the capacity to commit large-scale atrocities. The most recent of which is documented in detail by the Human Rights Watch report from December attacks. Two, the operations that have been going on over the past 16 to 18 months have pushed the LRA into new territories, especially up in the CAR, but also farther north in DRC. Into new communities, and the LRA are committing attacks and atrocities over a much wider area than in the immediate aftermath of Operation Lightning Thunder. National armies and UN peacekeeping forces, Paul writes, who are deployed in the region are inadequate to the task of protecting civilians, and that they won't be able to do so without a huge influx in capacity and dramatic improvements in intelligence sharing among the various groups and militaries involved. None of which is happening, and I think is unlikely to happen in the near future. Three, Paul points out, like the ICG report, that the UPDF-led operations are having some success in capturing or killing or leading to the defection, the surrender of some LRA commanders and fighters. But he noted in his presentation that it's unclear whether the rate of progress in these operations in their current configuration can actually succeed in stopping LRA violence and apprehending top LRA leaders. Can this be successful? Paul is asking based on his interviews across, again, a wide swath of territory where they are active. And I would like to add to that, and if it can't be, if it isn't, if it's not likely to be, if it's not going to be successful, will this make things worse, a continuing operation along these lines? He points out that the two largest constraints on success so far were a lack of timely intelligence on the location of the top LRA commanders and fighters. The LRA have stopped using, except in rare instances, satellite phones. Most of the messages being passed back and forth between disparate groups and top leaders have been by runners. But the UPDF doesn't know where these guys are, often. And it's really hard for them to find them. And then logistical constraints. This, again, it's a wide swath of territory. The roads are poor or simply not there. The UPDF is stretched. Several instances where they pursued LRA, even fairly rapidly after there's an LRA attack, they'll pursue for a certain period of time or a certain distance, and then they'll stop. They say, you know, we don't have food for our soldiers. We can't continue. So there's all kinds of logistical constraints. Five, Paul argued to the U.S. Embassy in meetings after that in Washington with the main author of the Human Rights Watch report from earlier this year, based on the December 2009 massacres. Even Human Rights Watch is beginning to question, should this ongoing operation continue to be supported? It's just not working. The cost is too high. We need to come up with a different strategy. And what I'd like to talk about is to see if any of you have any ideas of what such a strategy could be. But that's the message, that groups that have supported the operation in many ways up to this point, including Resolve Uganda, are now seriously questioning whether that support should be continued. And then the last point that I'll extract from Paul's report to the embassy is that he asked a lot of questions, partly at my urging, about UPDF human rights violations, because they were so common in northern Uganda, and also about UPDF resource exploitation, illegal resource exploitation. Again, the Uganda Army has a long record of being very good at this. He obtained no concrete evidence of resource exploitation, relatively few instances of really severe UPDF, some rapes, killings, other kinds of serious abuses of civilians. More minor ones, but not very many serious ones. The resource exploitation, though, there were rumors in all three countries that the UPDF is mining gold, mining diamonds, exploiting timber. And until recently, one of the top commanders in southeastern CAR, where rumors of timber exploitation have been fairly extensive, was a commander who, in early and South Sudan, called Operation Iron Fist, was a well-known timber exporter. He's already got the skills, and there were rumors that he was involved in CAR. Again, nothing, no definite evidence from what Paul learned. I would not be surprised if that was going on. Certainly, there's a long track record.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much, Rob. Yeah, so clearly, many themes, many questions, and a lot of you in this room, I know, work on either Northern Uganda or Southern Sudan or the Great Lakes, generally speaking, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions to Ron. Who'd like to start us off?
This might seem to be irrelevant, but looking at that map, it reminds me of the 19th century, with the movement of groups like Rabi Zubair and Al-Sanusi, of just moving their operations out of where they began. And that raises the question of what is the internal dynamic of the LRA if they're now moving out of Uganda, and therefore the sort of original reason for the LRA no longer seems to exist. What is the internal dynamic? What is the reason for the coherence? Is it now that because they commit atrocities, they have to stick together because they are generating a certain amount of resistance everywhere they go? They clearly don't have any realistic expectation of seizing control of any sort of state or creating a new state. So what is it that is keeping them going and keeping them together?
Mm-hmm. Should we take one at a time?
Or? Maybe start with that one, and then we might take a few. Yep.
It's really the only information, recent information we have about this, sort of direct information, comes from captured or captured LRA or people who've defected, turned themselves into UPDF. It's often really hard to know whether that's accurate information because of the way the UPDF questions and because of what they want to hear. But my sense is, and again, others of you may know more about this than I, my sense is a couple of things. One, it's clear that the LRA has been making for some time sort of outreach to various groups in these areas. One of the reasons that I was told by some of Vincent Otie's junior officers that Otie was killed by Cohen was that Otie really wanted to open a second LRA front way down in the Kivus. Because he'd made contact with groups in that very troubled area and was interested in sort of splitting the LRA up and you know really putting some of them much farther south. So the LRA's been doing this for some time in the area. I've been told that there are CAR militias who interpose themselves between UPDF chasing LRA to kind of deflect or postpone, etc. So clearly, that's one of the tactics. They're just making various kinds of alliances. It seems to me one possible outcome, if it's not already there, is that the LRA are just one more armed group in territories that aren't really controlled by governments. I mean, that's certainly what they are now. That may be their however long a future they might have. But my sense is also that the LRA may well be trying to hold on. Or at least some of the LRA would have this in mind, to hold on to see what happens in South Sudan. Because if South Sudan implodes as a result of the referendum or whenever, the LRA, again, have a long history of operating in South Sudan as one armed group among many on behalf of Khartoum, and they could well play that role again if things really crash in South Sudan. It's really unclear. There are all kinds of reports or suggestions that the LRA are being armed again, at least to some degree, by the Khartoum government. The evidence isn't very good for that, and in a number of recent LRA attacks all over the region, there's a pretty clear pattern of the LRA being very careful about, well, first of all, many of them don't have guns, and secondly, they're using bullets very carefully. So if they're being resupplied by Khartoum, they're not being resupplied very well. But certainly that's a potential for the future. And if South Sudan really does become really chaotic and violent, the LRA could play a role like they did before during the earlier war, a very useful ally in Khartoum. The SPLA, the LRA fought more battles, sort of real battles, against SPLA than they ever did against the UPDF. And my understanding is they're very effective. And the SPLA now in Western Equatoria basically they rarely, rarely even come close to engaging the LRA. They will wait. They'll pursue, but when there's not much chance of actually engaging. So that's I think those are the two options. Either become one militia in this area among many, make alliances, figure out how to play a role, or see what happens in South Sudan. That's the only way they can really become an effective force that could impinge again on Uganda. That's my sense. I don't know, anybody want to add what your sense is?
Can I just follow on with a question? Ultimately, if they were to use that type of strategy, they still have to have an end goal. And is it economic? Is it that they just see themselves as perpetuating a regime of marauding and resource sourcing to keep themselves going? Or, I mean, they seem to have been, like many groups, constantly on the move.
They are. But one of the things that's really interesting about the LRA, I mean, there's, as with many of the countries in this region, there's a really dominant narrative about what all this is about. Mm-hmm. And that dominant narrative includes the fact that the LRA as a group, and certainly Joseph Kone as its head, is sort of crazy. There's no political agenda, etc. There's lots of evidence that that's not true. They have had a political agenda. It has been to overthrow the Museveni regime, to begin to redress some of the imbalances that people in northern Uganda have felt since Museveni came to power, etc. So. But at the same time, the LRA is continually kind of reshaping itself and reforming its strategies, etc. So, but they have had a political goal. Whether that's even feasible to think that they could, I mean, they've never been a legitimate representative of those goals, but they've had them. Whether that could be reprised again if South Sudan really implodes. Also, Uganda has elections in 2011 as well. And it's really, there are lots of signs that those elections could be troubled. And I can't imagine northern Uganda or people in northern Uganda being very interested in being on the front line of any kind of conflict if they could help it. But the LRA might think so.
We might link up sort of two or three questions here.
Yeah,
so
but
there's a lot of hands.
Anybody
so
want to follow up on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, if there's anything specifically on that theme.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, Louise, and we might come to Caleb. Yeah.
I have more questions later, maybe. But
sure.
Specifically on that, I thought at some point there was an interesting dynamic. You mentioned the political agenda of the LRA, but at some point I thought there was almost an ethnical agenda when Kony was targeting people of northern Uganda. And the theory was potentially he was trying to have come up with a new actually pure, actually race, you know, by sort of targeting the civilians who may have backed the government. Now, the fact that the LRA have sort of now moved away from northern Uganda and is attacking, recruiting civilians from, you know, the region, in a way that agenda doesn't really stand. I think it's an interesting thing to consider.
Caleb, could yours connect onto this? Or is it on something
else? It doesn't quite connect to that, but it does connect to the political motive question.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that it appears that they're beginning to control certain territories, and I was just thinking, I was wondering if you could elaborate on precisely what you meant.
To be honest, to me, it's very unclear exactly what that means. My sense is my sense is that they are simply able, because they have a great enough presence and they feel secure enough, to really have some, I mean, it's control in a very vague and I think loose sense. It's not trying to establish any kind of institutions or whatever. It's just that's a territory within which they can operate with relative security. That's my sense. Thank you.
Just a separate question that might be somewhat indirectly related. What is the purported, interest of the U.S. in backing the UND? and what, in your view, is the real interest of the U.S.?
Okay. Again, should we?
Yeah.
I have a question actually really on that, on the relationship between the UPDF and the US. I mean, sort of looking back in the past, whenever there was a UPDF attack on the LRA, you mentioned yourself, usually it was a failure and then the LRA was responding. And the traditional UPDF tactic, especially with the US, was to say, look, our military budget is too small. We want to crush the LRA, but we can't. Please give us more money. And I'm just wondering, I don't really understand how come the US is buying into that. Is it still the sort of the terrorist thing, the LRA being a terrorist group? And up to a point, I want to link this to the ICC because, as far as I know, the RS warrant is still active, and what is Interpol doing? And if we want to capture Kony alive, presumably for him to be trialed, well, a sort of strong military operation, for me, doesn't look like that's the right strategy. And is this linked to the fact that the US is not, you know, doesn't really care about the ICC and therefore they're good?
Sure.
Yeah, also following up on the U.S., so you mentioned the ICG report said it was Bush who called Kabila
and Kiir.
And Kiir. I mean, is there any change of strategy with the new administration?
Yeah, do you want to take those, Ron?
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Those are all really good questions. The first point to deal with in terms of the pure Acholi race Cohen idea. I don't think that's ever been an issue with Cohen. That's not my sense at all. Most of his fighters, most of his abductees, most of his victims until this last year and a half or so have been Acholi in northern Uganda. But that has to do with all kinds of other dynamics, I think, than that. And with respect to recent abductions, a couple of things. One, my sense, what I was told, what I learned during the peace talks, again, from former abductees who got away, from former LRA guys, from other researchers like Mareka Shumarus, who really knows the LRA in South Sudan, is that the LRA, during the peace talks, despite what Ocampo was saying, despite what the US was saying, despite what lots of people were saying, was not using the peace talks to really to add to his fighting force. My sense was is that almost no abductees during the peace talks in this region, and there were abductees going on at a relatively low level during the peace talks, none of them were trained as fighters. They were all working in fields, carrying things, and if they were young women, some of them became forced wives. But not fighters. And that makes sense in all kinds of ways, but that's a very strong sense. Now, recently, that seems to be changing with the most recent abductees over the past sort of 6 months or so. Although, again, the complications of making these abductees in this area that don't speak Luo, Acholi Luo, et cetera, fighters is really problematic. And I think the only sense that they are being used as fighters is they're ordered to kill with clubs or something, but they're not fighters in the sense that they're being trained in arms or anything like that. So if I can, and then we can talk about it a bit more a bit later if you'd like. Okay, the U.S. And perhaps the link to the ICC. the U.S. has been a strong supporter of Museveni since the Clinton administration. Clinton proclaimed him one of the new breed of African leaders, etc. He's got this image, partly based on that, partly based because of his really full embrace of the Washington Consensus, IMF, World Bank, etc. So he's been a darling of the U.S. for a long time. That's part of it. The Bush administration had an even greater interest. Some of it does have to do with the war on terror, Uganda being the front line of sort of the Islamic and sometimes radically Islamic Khartoum government. So there's that kind of longer term history. More directly and recently, Bush's Assistant Secretary of State for Africa in his second term was a woman named Jendai Frazier. And Jendai Frazier was absolutely a Museveni supporter. She would not even talk to people. Even her former mentor in the State Department, a meeting was set up with him and another State Department person to raise some issues about Museveni and his government. She wouldn't even meet with him. I mean, totally figuratively in bed with Museveni. To a degree that's really hard to understand, but it was true. So, again, then Uganda supported whatever it does, basically. And that was true under the Bush administration. In addition, Bush had all kinds of reasons for a more personal connection with Museveni. One of them has to do with fundamentalist religion. That was a real connection between the two of them. At least Museveni made that a real connection. And then, on top of that, there is this new command structure in the U.S. military called AFRICOM that's long been based in Europe. AFRICOM was just organized. One of its first real operations was getting involved in Operation Lightning Thunder and subsequently. So it's this new structure of the military trying to carve out a role, to have a role, as they are trying to locate a base in Africa. So that's part of it. The U.S. position does seem to be changing with the new administration to some extent. I don't know about this particular aspect of the relationship, this involvement with the UPDF in this area, but clearly this new U.S. administration is less, in its statements and its actions, less totally in support of Museveni. There's been criticisms of the upcoming elections. You may have seen that in the press lately. A report attributed to Hillary Clinton raising some issues that Museveni basically says, "Is this woman to be advising me about democracy, etc." But the new Assistant Secretary of State, it was sometime before he was appointed. This was so far down the list of priorities that it took a while. It's a guy named Johnny Carson, former ambassador in Uganda, who has written some critical things about some of the sheen coming off Museveni's reputation from several years ago. I think there is a more critical look being taken now. The current ambassador, it's hard to know what his position is, but he is an Obama administration appointee. My sense is, from just a brief meeting and from talking to people, that he is, again, less totally supportive of the Uganda government than the previous ambassador. Related to that, when I went to the embassy during the peace talks at some point, I went to talk to the public affairs officer, because I've been a Fulbrighter and just wanted to sort of chat, etc. And there was a new American in that position, and I just pointed out sort of some criticisms of the U.S. non-involvement in the peace talks until the very end. And she got so offended. And then the deputy chief of mission sort of joined the discussion, and he said, yeah. And they both said, you know, we are involved, but we're just involved behind the scenes. And then the deputy chief of mission, who was new there, said with no trace of irony at all, said, He said, yeah, we are really involved. This is what Museveni wants us to do. And that was their line. So anyway, that may be changing. I was criticized when I did a report on some commentary on the International Peace Institute paper in January, just after it came out at the U.S. Embassy. I was criticized for being naive for some of what I said. And after talking to some of these people, it's a term that it seems they should be careful about using.
Ron, just wondering if we could switch attention to the situation in northern Uganda at the moment, and given the amount of time you've spent out there recently. Clearly, many of the IDP camps have been dismantled. People are starting to go home. How do you assess the situation now? How secure are people? How secure do they believe they are? I mean, in the last couple of years, I mean, certainly something I keep hearing in northern Uganda is that it's all well and good that the LRA have decamped to Garamba, but they still exist. And as long as they exist, it still poses at least a psychological threat to people living in the north. And of course, what we know from past experience is that the LRA often operates in small groups anyway, that many of the major attacks that they carried out over those 20 years were in small numbers against northern Ugandan civilians. So even as long as they exist in Garamba, that potential threat still seems there. How do you read the kind of civilian and security situation? And I think it's connected to a second and maybe slightly broader question, which is the Juba peace talks went on for 2 years, and you know, in many ways were quite remarkable negotiations. I mean, if we look at the agreements that came out of it, the fact that the parties actually stayed at the table in Juba for 2 years, well, what's the legacy of that? I mean, there's been a great deal of gnashing of teeth, of course, that Kony didn't sign the final part of the agreement, and so it looks like the negotiations in that sense fell apart. But presumably there's some residue from those discussions, and we continue to see the agreements referred to in Ugandan politics. It's significant, for example, that there's an accountability and reconciliation component to it, which is at least being acted upon within the national judiciary in Kampala. What's the legacy of those Juba talks? Can they be resumed? If we were to see another wave of peace negotiations, would we have to start from scratch, or would they use Juba as a basis? What's the overflow from that whole process? Okay. I wonder if there's maybe a couple of other questions sort of along those lines. Yeah.
Maybe an old but recurring question. I was wondering to what extent is the government at Kampala, is Museveni not willing or not able to actually end the LRA threat? So when you talk about the UPDF and that there might have been informants so that Kony knew, is that something Museveni can't control, or is that actually maybe something in Museveni's interest? So does he actually, might he still be interested in having this threat for all the reasons that have been named, support, international community in the north, and so on and so forth?
Pat and then Douglas, yeah.
Being along with what
Henny
was saying, I mean, for Museveni, arguably, having the north jungle still allows him to remain the darling of the Washington consensus. Still, Uganda is still seen as definitely a developing country coming out of conflict. Had that north been allowed to become an opposition party, couldn't that seriously pose a threat to his continued role? And furthermore, just a side question, slightly unrelated, sorry. But in terms of Operation Lightning Thunder, how has that affected DDR and disarmament of the LRA, and particularly, if I'm not sure if maybe your research sheds some light on this, but what is the interaction between LRA trying to demobilize and UPDF soldiers?
Yes, I mean, going back to the Juba talks, I'm curious, what is the relationship between Riek Machar and the LRA, given that at one time Riek Machar was kind of an intermediary between Khartoum and the LRA in the opposition to the SPLA. Was that a complicating factor in the peace talks itself?
Should we take those right?
Okay. All right. Okay, first, Philip, then to your the first question about the current situation in northern Uganda. I think there are concerns that are lurking in many people's minds about the LRA, but I think they're fairly back in people's minds because there are so many more immediate issues and often problems for people as they make the complicated decision to try and stay in the camps, because there's still, I don't know what the percentage is now in the camps, you've seen recent figures, maybe 20%, something like, in Acholi. And the rest of the north, it's almost gone, but some 20%, 25%. And historically, after long periods of displacement, there tends to be, you know, 25, a quarter to a third of people who don't leave, who don't go home. So those are complicated and difficult decisions. For the majority of people that have gone home, there are all the very hard, practical tasks that they have to deal with. Reconstructing farms, building huts, trying to get access to safe water points, trying to see if there's a place their kids can go to school, try to see that a school can be reconstructed or built so their kids can go to school. Dealing with land issues, land disputes. In one of the Acholi districts in particular, Amuru district, land disputes are common and sometimes violent. Sometimes between neighboring communal landholding groups that dispute boundaries, sometimes within communal landholding groups, within lineages, therefore, or clans, sometimes large tracts of land being claimed by powerful people in the National Resistance Movement or the Ugandan military. And that's again, been especially common in Amuru. At the same time, in many other areas, local leaders, lineage leaders, the old traditional Acholi chiefs are really handling these issues. And when there are issues over land, they are being dealt with peacefully through procedures that hark back to earlier periods in Acholi history. But I think for most people, again, there's some concern that's diminished ever since Operation Lightning Thunder, that the LRA are out there. It's still there, but I think these other things are so pressing. And then just local politics and the upcoming elections and opposition parties beginning to campaign. I mean, all that's what's in the foreground, it seems to me. But I think certainly immediately after Operation Lightning Thunder began, I mean, some people said, back, even if they're far away, they can come back. They're really good. They're really skilled. I think it is still there. Okay, the Juba talks. And again, any of you who've been to Northern Uganda recently and want to add on, please do so. The Juba talks. The Juba talks really, really were quite remarkable, as you suggest. And the book that Tim and Cohen are bringing out shortly on the LRA. I've got a chapter in there on the peace talks, fairly extensive chapter. In terms of now, in practical terms, I mean, there are some things going on with the judiciary, but mostly the Uganda government, despite calls to implement what their delegation signed on to in Juba, there's little indication that there's any serious commitment to doing so. And people know that. So if in the north, if there's a residue, it's mostly one, okay, the government's not following through. And there are frequent calls from all sorts of groups for them to do so. My sense is that they're not. I'll be curious to see if they ever are. And that includes things like the Peace Recovery and Development Plan, the PRDP plan, which remains mostly something on paper and not something that's actually happening. But the Juba talks are out there. I mean, you know, sort of that those documents were signed. They're out there. They could be, at least in terms of calling the Uganda government to fulfill its commitments that they signed on to, I think that's still something that could happen and might well happen. That's my sense. Um, with respect to Machar and the peace talks and subsequently, my sense is that the peace talks in Juba, well, the Goss mediating the talks would not have occurred without Garang's death. Garang wouldn't have done it, first of all. Secondly, the LRA would have never talked with the SPLA. Second. So Garang's death was an absolute necessary precursor to the Goss playing the role in the peace talks. It also mattered that two of the top three people in the Goss at that point, Machar, Matip Nial, both had prior connections with the LRA. And they were people the LRA had dealt with, and I think felt they could deal with. So I think that Machar was initially a crucial factor in the talks beginning. The LRA delegation, though, became very disenchanted with Machar over the course of the talks, especially in the early days of the talks. When they pulled out of the talks initially for a period in early 2007, after they broke for Christmas, after the first 6 months or 5 months of the talk, a lot of their complaints had to do with Machar's mediation and not being even handed or fair to the LRA delegation. So there was some disaffection, but Machar has been important to the talks. He also did not want Operation Lightning Thunder to happen. And one of the reasons that the reports are that the Goss was kept out of any of the real planning or even being notified until it began is because the Uganda government feared Machar would get word to the LRA. That's not how Cone got word. He doesn't need Machar to get information, intelligence from the UPDF. But Machar's been really important, and I think he could be important in the future, possibly. In terms of Museveni being unable or unwilling to defeat Cohn, is there still benefits to Museveni in having the LRA and Cohn out there? I think that's been true historically. My very strong sense is that Operation Lightning Thunder was intended to get Cohn, to finish the LRA. Then, for the first time perhaps, or at least most obviously, Museveni was really committed to that happening. And that's why he actually ended up approving an operation that highlighted people right around him. The commander of the operation comes from his village. Nkosi, his son, the head of special forces, was supposed to be leading those helicopter gunship operations against people surviving the bombings. It was all an inside sort of plan to basically bring glory to especially his son, who would have demonstrated his military chops. Finally, his son is the one who got Cohn. So I think that was really, I think that's been true. And there certainly are some advantages to the UPDF to continue getting this financial and other support from the U.S. But my sense is it's even more a frustration and an embarrassment now. I don't think this is helping Museveni.
There was annoyance from the U.S. on that front too, wasn't there? The fact that there had been sort of good coordination between the U.S. and the UPDF leading up to the operation, but UPDF broke ranks at the last minute and essentially did what they wanted. I mean, which must have caused a fair amount of consternation in Washington, I would have thought.
I actually don't know very many of those details, but yeah, there's certainly the plan was not followed for sure. And all of the top UPDF guys, except that very narrow group, were totally excluded from what actually happened. And there was lots of disaffection among the top UPDF commanders that they had been totally bypassed in this operation. So yeah. I think there's disaffection on all sides, and it really backfired. It really backfired. So I think Museveni now is not, and he wants to get going.
Really quick and related to this, and just your opinion, but how do you think Tony found out prior to the air hunts?
my sense is just that there are people in UPDF who let them know. Yeah. And he uses this inside information to his advantage in all kinds of ways, conducts. But he's certainly got it. That's my sense. There was one other thing about DDR, an Operation Lightning Thunder affecting the DDR is no, I mean there's no real DDR program. I mean, it was part of the peace talks, but there's no program. Essentially, if the UPDF if people turn themselves into UPDF, I mean they're debriefed depending on how important they are. What kind of debriefing they get. If they're captured, the same sort of thing happens. Former LRA are often kept under pretty tight wraps by the UPDF for some time. If they're not encouraged or made to actually join the UPDF and be part of the hunt for Kong, because that's certainly a major factor, a major part of what's going on now. A lot of recent LRA guys are trying to help or supposedly helping or being used to help the UPDF track and find LRA.
Give information to Connie when an attack is about
I don't think I don't know if they've got the means to do that now, but they might. But also really interesting, the attack, there was an attack in October in Western Bahr Ghazal, way north near Rajah, I think. I don't know if it's on the map or not. No, it's not. But anyway, Marijke Schulmerus, when she was there on her DFID project for the elections, talked to some people who had been abducted in that attack. And again, some really interesting details. There were about 40 LRA, well, it's not absolutely clear they were LRA, but almost certainly. And that's another thing, it's not always clear who's doing what. But assuming they were LRA, there were about 40 of them. Only 10 of them had guns. Essentially a shopping expedition. They were there to get loot. They killed two policemen, two businessmen. They used four bullets, I think, or five maybe, to kill all four of them. The commander of the group had a satellite phone. And as they were leaving, with abductees carrying this loot, suffering no casualties themselves, she got a call on her satellite phone saying the SPLA is after you. So they adjusted accordingly and escaped. So typically, the high command is not using satellite phones, but that's the only instance I've heard of one of the sort of the small groups who are actually attacking using a satellite. But evidently, that was the story that Marijke got.
Just a more detailed question around operational size. When the sort of dispersement took place, is there a sense of the size that the actual units are broken down into and how many there are?
In the initial, after the bombings? I think it varied quite a bit. I mean, some of them were really small groups, 20 or less. Some of them were significantly larger than that. And then they, in turn, eventually often broken down. But it's so hard now to have any realistic sense of numbers.
The reason I ask is that part of our work is always looking at the structures of the organizations and how the changing nature of the structure, often represented by the size of various units, can begin to start giving clues as to the nature of the command structure and even some of the more sort of fundamental natures of the group. I was just curious if you've been seeing any changes in some of those operational units and how they're relating and or coming together and dividing again.
Yeah. I've not seen very much information about this coming together and sort of larger coalescences. So I don't really know what that's about. Clearly, the groups have changed in their nature because they are using local people to do some of the killing. Again, not with guns, as far as I know, ever. But some of the killing, and some are evidently being trained now as fighters with firearms. That's changing. But again, the LRA has been doing this all along. It would be really interesting to know how many of the LRA now are actually Ugandan in origin. Because a lot of the Acholi in the LRA, when the peace talks began, were South Sudanese Acholi, not Ugandan Acholi. So, but I'm afraid I don't have any good information. You probably have more than I do.
We've got about another 10 minutes, so maybe sort of one last round of questions. I think, yeah, Caleb.
I guess this goes back to what I kind of just asked, or related to that. In light of the fact that you think Khuzemni was actually interested in capturing top LRA leadership in the operation like Thunder, how is it just UPDF disorganization that would explain the delay in their arrival at LRA sites after the bombings? Or I'm just trying to tease out whether or not there was a coordinated, deliberate failure of the operation for whatever reason, which goes back to the unwilling or unable question.
Yeah, it almost looks like it. I mean, it's almost, again, it's just inconceivable what happened if it was a serious operation. One of the things that I've been told, and that I think it's been in the Independent, is that the initial bombing runs were supposed to be MiGs, but they're old MiGs, and they were taken off from Uganda, and I was told that their fuel capacity wasn't sufficient for them to actually leave their bases in Uganda, do the bombing runs, and get back. So they were aborted because of that. That's crazy stuff, but. The Ugandan army is rife with inefficiencies and corruption. So I don't know, but it's hard to imagine that it wasn't intentional given how badly it was carried off. But I have a really strong sense that no, this was intended to finally get going, and give Mohosi in particular the credit for doing so.
And the election's coming up.
Yeah, and the election's coming up as well. Yeah.
Are you basing that sort of conviction about Khuzemni's intention on just the number of forces that he deployed in that, or the risk he took in terms of international opinion and sort of making that attempt, or what exactly is motivating that?
I think the strongest indication to me is the fact of how this actually was operationalized. That it was this small clique right around Khuzemni, including his son, who was going to play a major role. That's the greatest indicator. I mean, there are lots of other contextuals, the elections, the fact that the Uganda Army and Khuzemni were just waiting for the peace talks to fall apart. I mean, they'd been planning this for a long time. Right? If the U.S. only got involved in June, the Uganda Army had a plan B from the beginning. And was 70 expressed to Jan Egeland and to all kinds of other people. He didn't believe in these peace talks, so they were just waiting. So I think that whole combination.
I know there are several questions still to go. There's another group hovering with sinister intent to take this route. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they're the informal justice discussion group. And if there are people you don't want to mess with in Oxford, it's the informal justice discussion group. So I think what we might do is actually just close things off here before they sort of invade. Ron, as always, it's a real pleasure for us to have you here in Oxford. We always have a really engaging discussion every time you come through. You've always got new updates and new information. So we're really grateful for you being here and taking part in this and answering all of our questions in the systematic way that you have. We hope to have you back here soon for more information on what's happening with the LRA and Northern Uganda and the region as a whole. And I'm sure everyone would want to join me in thanking you very much for being here. Thanks, Ron.